session number 30304.
Sedrina, reel 31.
So it can be seen that as soon as possible, a search would be established to try to find any trace of the two aircraft, M and O. Meeting one's end to life on Earth in this way is, in my opinion, the worst of all the possibilities facing an airman. Being, for instance, shot down, horrible, but you have some feeling about death is coming, perhaps. Crashing, you may or may not survive. Bailing out, at least you've got a chance. Being shot at, you may be hit, you may not. Ditching, all these are preferable, I'm sure, to being completely enveloped in a turbulent blanket of white, losing height, which would come sooner or later because perhaps of icing or running out of petrol, having no idea of what was beneath or ahead. I think running out of petrol in those circumstances is probably the worst. The engines falter. Probably one of them will stop first, which will affect the stability of the aircraft, obviously. You're in an utter unavoidable descent, losing control. You can't even see what you're going to crash into. It may be the side of a fjord, it may be an iceberg, it may be ice-covered sea. The ice may be strong enough to avoid cracking and letting the aircraft through into the freezing water below. The temperature, because the aircraft could not survive intact, would be cold enough to deprive a human body of life in a very, very short time, full of suffering. So that was the farewell to two great colleagues. Various searches for the missing. The Diary of Missing Searches is a continuation of what I've just referred to as the Squadron's Operational Record Book. And it's pretty lengthy, so obviously I'll keep it fairly brief. On March the 2nd, we started getting ready, and we did have a great deal of cooperation. The weather, however, was still unfit for flying. The blizzard continued. Snow and fog in the fjord even prevented the US Navy ships from going out to search. The bomb doors on aircraft G had been repaired, but of what use was that now? The other aircraft was serviceable. Anyway, the search was cooperatively organized by Colonel Sweeney, the U.S. Army Air Corps commander, and permission was sought from RAF Ferry Command to use its aircraft for search. And although it took a little longer, that was later granted. On the third, the weather was still, unfit for flying. The Danish governor of Greenland was requested to contact native settlers and discover if any aircraft had been seen or heard on March the 1st. On the 4th, the weather was fit for flying the morning only. On the 5th, still unfit for flying with more heavy snowfall and strong winds. On the 6th, the weather was unfit for flying. Lieutenant Commander Sewell instructed the U.S. Navy ship North Star to search the northern part of the area, but snow, poor visibility, and gale winds continued to delay this operation. And it was on the 6th of March, so I was incorrect previously in suggesting that we had a signal from Iceland. We did have, but it wasn't with reference to that. Signal from Iceland, detachment being withdrawn, list requirements. On the 7th, the weather was fit for flying. Due to extreme cold and difficulties in starting the preheaters, there were only two aircraft airborne. On the 8th, weather was unfit for flying, but a village 20 miles south of Gotthab, which was on the west coast fairly close, reported seeing an aircraft circling during the afternoon of the 1st of March. Exact time unknown. Could that have been aircraft O? The village of Kangamuit, north of Sukkotappen, reported hearing aircraft engines at approximately midday on the 1st of March. Could that have been aircraft M? Locals were instructed to carry out searches in fjords adjacent to their villages when weather was fit for kayaks. So it went on with more searches each day when the weather was fit. On the 13th, for instance, weather was fit for flying. The area search was limited by meeting bad weather north of Gotthab. Aircraft G searched the area Cape Desolation to Gotthab. Bad weather prevented passage to BW8. One Hudson, four B-25s, and one Ventura also carried out searches. On the 14th, weather was fit for flying. Aircraft G searched the area north of Gotthab to Cruncher, way up to South Strongfjord, and landed at BW8. So for the first time in 13 days, we had covered, one aircraft had covered the area between our base and the base up inside the Arctic Circle. But of course there'd been so much snow and so much drifting in the blizzard in those intervening days, it was impossible to suppose that anything that had been left, if an aircraft had crashed, would be seen. It would be well covered by that time. Anyway, one Hudson, three B-25s, and one Catalina also carried out searches. And our aircraft G, now stayed up at BW8 and searched around there locally. On the 15th, weather was fit for flying at BW8, but the aircraft was now US. But aircraft wreckage was reported from the Danish governor at Julianehaab. The position of the wreckage was 4 miles north of Julianehaab. On the 16th, weather fit for flying at BW8, but aircraft still US. we allowed Sergeants Hafner and Hollis, two of our WAPAGs, to go back to Iceland on ferry aircraft. On the 17th, Warrant Officer Pugsley, my navigator, was dispatched to Yulianahab in the U.S. Navy cutter, along with USN and U.S. Army personnel, to identify the wreckage. But on the next day, the 18th, we learned that the wreckage was identified as a missing Catalina of U.S. Navy. So, up to the 22nd, the effort we made was considerable, but hindered so much by the weather that any hope of finding any traces was an impossible optimistic supposition. On the 22nd, weather was fit for flying at BW8, so Jimmy Haig in aircraft G returned to Blue West 1, carrying out a search on the journey. But searches by all aircraft were now discontinued. We requested the post commander that all aircraft flying from this station be informed of the necessity to apprehend any wreckage or signals, especially en route to BW8. Well, that was the way it was seen and reported in the operations record book. But thoughts were already occurring to most of us after the long, dismal wait. The lack of radio contact after 1345 hours on the 1st of March with Johnny Lane's crew in aircraft O suggested that the blizzard had claimed them. And we who were waiting anxiously, having flown in such conditions but in areas where high ground was not in evidence, were depressingly aware of what could have happened. It would seem that Johnny had not long left the point at Cruncher, where the fjord met the ocean, and had decided that he could perhaps make it back up the fjord. And I would assume that he was searching for the opening to the fjord and was too close, having to be close, of course, in order to even see anything when the blizzard had reached that point, and perhaps went into the cliff face. Well, Johnny and I had served in the same units since October 1940, and in the long hours of waiting for the news that never came, I despaired at the loss in such a way of so splendid a person and so skilled a pilot. In this barren place where German targets seemed beyond our reach, we knew that Harry, on his long journey north into the unknown, would press on as he had on so many occasions, not now against the dangers of enemy fire, but of clinging snow and ice, which would be trying to drag the aircraft down. Two of eight airmen whose loss the squadron could ill afford. Well, towards the end of March, to me the most miserable of all months during the war, the remaining 10 members of the detachment had no hesitation in agreeing wholeheartedly with the decision to withdraw. Even then, Greenland seemed reluctant to relax its icy grip, as the detachment report in the record book states. March the 24th, the 29th, between these dates, all aircraft, both aircraft, ready to return to Iceland, awaiting suitable weather. March 30th, aircraft G, airborne 8:30, landed Reykjavik, Iceland 13:30. Aircraft N, FO Reina, airborne 08:35, landed Reykjavik 13:40. Side was first. when we returned to Iceland, of course, there was a lot of deliberation about what had happened and why there hadn't been more cooperation and why this shouldn't still happen. But it came to be known, not least through books such as those published by Dennis Richards and Hilary St. G. Saunders about the Royal Air Force 1939-45, published by HMSO, that there was such debate amongst the hierarchy that about what could be done to cooperate better. Committees were formed, which in themselves spawned subcommittees, and there were even two quite high-ranking officers instructed to go round to all units which were concerned in basically in the Battle of the Atlantic, any units concerned with operations against U-boats or shipping, to try to formulate some plan. But the overriding impression that I got from later reading about these matters was that whereas in the East it was the U.S. Navy which was predominant in order to wipe the slate clean, as it were, compared with how they saw the Japanese entry into the war, compared with the coming land battles which the U.S. Army Air Force knew it would be taking part in, either from the air or on the land, remembering also the fact that there was great pressure from the Soviet Union that the Allies should open up an Eastern Front as soon as possible. 1943 was even mooted at one time, and of course it happened in 1944. There were so many contradicting theses about what was best. In the end, it just needed some almighty, if you like, to say, never mind about that, do this. But it never happened. There was, of course, good cooperation, excellent cooperation, as we all know. Later on, particularly in 1944, in covering the D-Day landings, for instance, and so on. But it certainly hadn't become evident to any great extent during our during 269's covering of the North Atlantic. So we still operated as a squadron with instructions from HQ Coastal Command through the Iceland group, and that was the way that things were going when we got back to Iceland.
Your return flight on the 30th, do Did you follow the same route back as you'd taken?
No. If you compare the actual flying times, you'll see, I think I'm right, that we got back more quickly than we got there. There were two reasons for that. Obviously, we waited for our departure from Iceland, I think a couple of days, for the wind to be in the right direction. We wanted a wind from the northeast in order to help us on our way. That wind didn't provide as much help as the wind from the opposite direction, the southwest, which we were waiting for when we left Greenland to go back to Iceland. So that was the first help that we got, that we were travelling at a faster ground speed, although the airspeed was the same, well, about the same setting on both trips. But also, having spent that amount of time, the two months in Greenland, and that was quite long enough, we knew more about the land, the geography of the place, and we'd flown over parts of the ice cap, which in itself is quite a remarkable thing to fly over. I might just diverge a little here to explain that, because it's something worth knowing. We flew over the ice cap as part of the search for the aircraft, missing aircraft, of course, M&O, and because the Americans had told us some, in a jocular mood, I think, that there were more than two dozen aircraft up on the ice cap, which nobody could, of course, move, and most of them got quickly covered in snow and ice. But it occurred to us, of course, when we were carrying out the searches, that that was still a very, very vague possibility, and that if one of them, and presumably Harry Ramsey in M, because he was in the air longest compared with the other aircraft, it could possibly have been. I mean, Harry had the sense, if he'd had the opportunity, I'm quite sure, to turn. It depends so much on circumstances, obviously. If you can imagine it, a blizzard and the awful terrain of the greenish, rocky coast. But if he'd happened to see a bit of clear sky or thinning sky on the seaward side, he would have had enough sense to turn that way in the hope that it might thin out sufficient for him to get up to the height. It's an incredible supposition, but it could have been done with good luck. And something he might well have thought about, I'm sure he would. To get up to even 10,000 feet would do, and then turn to get and actually land on the ice cap. What good that would have done in the longer term, even the next 24 hours, would remain a mystery and very much a matter of good fortune, because survival would have been difficult. But even so, I wouldn't have put it past his flying ability to sort of flat land keep the aircraft intact on the ice cap. So perhaps 24 hours they could have survived in the aircraft. I don't know, for 24 hours. It's such a long shot, it's almost fiction, but that's the sort of thing you have to think about in those circumstances. So we knew the ice cap, that's what I'm really talking about. And to fly over it is an unusual experience. And because on a clear day, there is no horizon. It's strange. You've got the white of the ice cap, and on a clear day, you've got the white of the sky. It's not blue up to, perhaps another 500 feet up. It's a white colour, so you've no horizon. And, 11,000 feet is... it's measured in feet, not in inches, but 6 inches of ice sticking out of the top beyond the level of the rest of it, and you think you're not anywhere near the surface of the ice cap, you can come into contact with something like that, and you've got to look down. You look down, and on the ice cap, there are many ripples. It's not absolutely smooth, like as though you're tobogganing down. It's got ripples on it. And when you're down, close at about, I would say, 50 feet or even lower, because you don't know that you are at that height, you're still flying on instruments, basically. You look down and you see these ripples just below the wing. So, anyway, that's how we came to know the surface of the ice cap quite well. It took on one or two occasions. And of course you don't know which way the ice cap is going, whether it's getting higher in front of you or it's getting lower, until you realize that the difference between the color of the ice cap and the color of the so-called blue sky. So we knew something about the ice cap, that's what I was really talking about. And we thought, well, looking at Bluey West, the position of Bluey West 1, it's about 50 miles from Cape Farewell, or more perhaps. We never measured it, but certainly at least 50. And we went round Cape Farewell on our outward journey to go to Bluey West 1, which added perhaps 150 nautical miles to the trip. So we thought, well, we can reduce that by flying over the southern part of the ice cap, making it a direct flight, a direct track to go back to Iceland. So we staggered up because, although it didn't make all that much difference, I suppose, but we were each carrying a couple of extra bodies and taking back the two mechanics and so on that we'd had. And we were up to about 9,000 feet, I think, and or some similar height, when one of the engines decided it didn't like it. So we turned on more heat on it and so on. And the Hudson's such a wonderful machine, really, in that kind of situation. It recovered. We got over the top. I think we were about 10,000 feet at that point, perhaps 500 feet above the ice cap. And although we used a lot of petrol, of course, in climbing up to get there, at least we had the benefit of a slow descent. I don't mean slow in speed, but an extended descent at a low angle, which would be using less petrol than if we'd been flying normally at a normal height. So that those two things combined, the more favorable following wind and the fact that we made a shorter journey, accounted for a faster flight back than going out.